They do have cunning and animalistic savvy. But I'm an experienced tracker. I know their spoor, the traces they leave, the way their presence charges the air. Things invisible or ephemeral to ordinary citizens, blackly obvious to me. The journal is so you'll know, just in case my luck runs out. Sundown. Nap time. Part 2. Naturally, the police think of me as some sort of homicidal crackpot. That's a given. Always has been for my predecessors. More watchers to evade. Caution comes reflexively to me these days. Police are slow and rational. They deal in the minutiae of a day-to-day world, deadly enough without the inclusion of bloodsuckers. The police love to stop and search people. Fortunately for me, mallets and stakes and crosses and such are not yet illegal in this country. Lots of raised eyebrows and jokes and nudging, but no actual arrests. When the time comes for them to recognize the plague that has descended upon their city, they will remember me. Perhaps with grace. My lot is friendless. Solo. I know and expect such. It's okay. City by city. I'm good at ferreting out the nests. To me, their kill patterns are like a flashing red light. The police only see presumed loonies, draw no linkages. They bust and imprison mortals and never see the light. I am not foolhardy enough to leave bloodsuckers lying. Even though the mean corpus usually dissolves, the stakes might be discovered. Sometimes there is other residue. City dumpsters and sewers provide adequate and fitting disposal for the leftovers of my mission. The enemy casualties. I wish I could advise the authorities, work hand in hand with them. Too complicated, too many variables. Not a good control situation. Bloodsuckers have a maddening knack for vanishing into crevices, even hairline splits in logic. Rule? Trust no one. Part 3. A female one today. Funny. There aren't as many of them as you might suppose. She had courted a human lover, so she claimed, like Romeo and Juliet. She could only visit him at night, and only after feeding, because bloodsuckers, too, can get carried away by passion. I think she was intimating that she was a physical lover of otherworldly skill. I think she was fighting hard to tempt me not to eliminate her by saying so. She did not use her mouth to seduce mortal men. I drove the stake into her brain, through the mouth. She was of recent vintage and did not melt or vaporize. When I fucked her remains, I was surprised to find her warm inside, not cold. Like a cadaver. Warm. With some of them, the human warmth is longer in leaving. But it always goes. Part 4. I never met one before that gave up its existence without a struggle, but today I did. One that acted like he had been expecting me to wander along and relieve him of the burden of unlife. He did not deny what he was, nor attempt to trick me. He asked if he could talk a bit before. In a third-floor loft, the windows of which had been spray-painted flat black, he talked. Said he had always hated the taste of blood. Said he preferred pineapple juice, or even coffee. He actually brewed a pot of coffee while we talked. I allowed him to finish his cup before I put the ashwood length to his chest and drove deep and let his blackness gush. It dribbled, thinned by the coffee he had consumed. Part 5. Was thinking this afternoon perhaps I should start packing a Polaroid or some such to keep a visual body count, just in case this journal becomes public record someday. It'd be good to have illustrations. Proof. I was thinking of that line you hear overused in the movies. I'm sure you know it, but there's no such thing as a vampire. What a howler. Ranks right up there alongside it's crazy, but it just might work, and we can't stop now for a lot of silly native superstitions. Right. Shoot cozy little memory snaps in case they whiz to mist or drop apart to smoking goo. That bull about how you're not supposed to be able to record their images is from the movies, too. There's so much misleading information running loose that the bloodsuckers, the real ones, have no trouble at all moving through any urban center with impunity, as they say on cop shows. Maybe it would be a good idea to tape record the sounds they make when they die. Videotape them begging not to be exterminated. That would bug the eyes of all those monster movie fans. You bet. Part 6. So many of them beleaguering this city, it's easy to feel outnumbered. Like I said, I've lost count. Tonight might be a good window for moving on. Like them, I become vulnerable if I remain too long, and it's prudent operating procedure not to leave patterns or become predictable. It's easy. I don't own much. Most of what I carry inside. Part 7. They pulled me over on Highway 10, outbound, for a broken left taillight. A datafax photo of me was clipped to the visor in the highway patrol car. The journal book itself has been taken as evidence, so for now it's a felt tip and high school notebook paper, which notes I hope to append to the journal proper later. I have a cell with 4 bunks all to myself. The door is solid gray with a food slot, unlike the barred cage of the bullpen. On the way back, I noticed they had caught themselves a bloodsucker. Probably an accident. They probably don't even know what they have. There is no sunrise or sunset in the block, so if he gets out at night, they'll never know what happened. But I already know. Right now, I will not say anything. I am exposed and at a disadvantage. The one I let slip today, I can eliminate tenfold next week. Part 8. New week, and I am vindicated at last. I relaxed as soon as they showed me the photographs. How they managed documentation on the last few bloodsuckers I trapped, I have no idea. But I was relieved. Now I don't have to explain the journal, which, as you can see, they returned to me immediately. They had thousands of questions. They needed to know about the mallets, the stakes, the preferred method of killstrike. I cautioned them not to attempt to sweep and clear at night, when the enemy is stronger. They paid serious attention this time, which made me feel much better. Now the fight can be mounted en masse. They also let me know I wouldn't have to stay in the cell. Just some paperwork to clear, and I'm out among them again. One of the officials, not a cop, but a doctor, congratulated me on a stout job well done. He shook my hand on behalf of all of them, he said, and mentioned writing a book on my work. This is exciting. As per my request, the bloodsucker in the adjacent solitary cell was moved. I told them that to be really sure, they should use one of my stakes. It was simple vanity, really, on my part. I turned my stakes out of ashwood on a lathe. I made sure they knew I'd permit my stakes to be used as working models for the proper manufacture of all they would soon need. When the guards come back, I really must ask how they managed such crisp 8x10s of so many bloodsuckers. All those names and dates. First-class documentation. I'm afraid I may be a bit envious.
Classic Tales. 4 Wooden Stakes by Victor Roman. Victor Roman appears to be a mystery figure with no information about him available. He is listed on one website as an African-American author, but there is no evidence to either support or refute this. There is no listing of any other works by him, though this story has been reprinted on numerous occasions and has deservedly risen to the status of a classic in the genre. Four Wooden Stakes was apparently first published in the February 1925 issue of Weird Tales. It was first published in Great Britain in the first volume of the highly successful Not at Night series, edited by Christine Campbell Thompson. London, Selwyn and Blount, 1925.
Four Wooden Stakes by Victor Roman. Read by Robin Sachs. There it lay on the desk in front of me, that missive so simple in wording, yet so perplexing, so urgent in tone. Jack, come at once for old time's sake. Am all alone. Will explain upon arrival. Remsen. Having spent the past 3 weeks in bringing to a successful termination a case that had puzzled the police and two of the best detective agencies in the city, I decided that I was entitled to a rest, so I ordered two suitcases packed and went in search of a timetable. It was several years since I had seen Remsen Holroyd. In fact, I had not seen him since we had matriculated from college together. I was curious to know how he was getting along, to say nothing of the little diversion he promised me in the way of a mystery. The following afternoon found me standing on the platform of the little town of Charing, a village of about 1,500 souls. Remsen's place was about 10 miles from there, so I stepped forward to the driver of a shay and asked if he would kindly take me to the Holroyd estate. He clasped his hands in what seemed a silent prayer, shuddered slightly, then looked at me with an air of wonder mingled with suspicion.
"I don't know what you wants to go out there for, stranger, but if you'll take the advice of a God-fearing man, you'll turn back whence you come from. There be some mighty fearful tales concerning that place floating around, and more'n one tramp's been found near there so weak from loss of blood and fear he could hardly crawl. There's something there. Be it man or beast, I don't know, but as for me, I wouldn't drive you out there for $100 cash."
This was not at all encouraging, but I was not to be influenced by the talk of a superstitious old gossip, so I cast about for a less impressionable rustic who would undertake the trip to earn the ample reward I promised at the end of my ride. To my chagrin, they all acted like the first. Some crossed themselves fervently, while others gave me one wild look and ran, as if I were in alliance with the devil. By now my curiosity was thoroughly aroused, and I was determined to see the thing through to a finish if it cost me my life. So, casting a last contemptuous look upon those poor souls, I stepped out briskly in the direction pointed out to me. However, I had gone but a scant 2 miles when the weight of the suitcases began to tell, and I slackened pace considerably. The sun was just disappearing beneath the treetops when I caught my first glimpse of the old homestead, now deserted but for its one occupant. Time and the elements had laid heavy hands upon it, for there was hardly a window that could boast its full quota of panes, while the shutters banged and creaked with a noise dismal enough to daunt even the strong of heart. About 100 yards back, I discerned a small building of grey stone, pieces of which seemed to be lying all around it, partly covered by the dense growth of vegetation that overran the entire countryside. On closer observation, I realized that the building was a crypt, while what I had taken to be pieces of the materials scattered around were really tombstones. Evidently, this was the family burying ground. But why had certain members been interred in a mausoleum, while the remainder of the family had been buried in the ground, in the usual manner? Having observed thus much, I turned my steps towards the house, for I had no intention of spending the night with naught but the dead for company. Indeed, I began to realize just why those simple country folk had refused to aid me, and a hesitant doubt began to assert itself as to the expedience of my being here, when I might have been at the shore or at the country club enjoying life to the full. By now the sun had completely slid from view, and in the semi-darkness the place presented an even drearier aspect than before. With a great display of bravado, I stepped upon the veranda, slammed my suitcases upon a seat very much the worse for wear, and pulled lustily at the knob. Peal after peal reverberated through the house, echoing and re-echoing from room to room, till the whole structure rang. Then all was still once more, save for the sighing of the wind and the creaking of the shutters. A few minutes passed, and the sound of footsteps approaching the door reached my ears. Another interval, and the door was cautiously opened a few inches, while a head, shrouded by the darkness, scrutinized me closely. Then the door was flung wide, and Remsen, I hardly knew him, so changed was he, rushed forward and, throwing his arms around me, thanked me again and again for heeding his plea, till I thought he would go into hysterics. I begged him to brace up, and the sound of my voice seemed to help him, for he apologized rather shamefacedly for his discourtesy and led the way along the wide hall. There was a fire blazing merrily away in the sitting room, and after partaking generously of a repast, for I was famished after my long walk, I was seated in front of it, facing Remsen, and waiting to hear his story. "Jack," he began, "I'll start at the beginning and try and give you the facts in their proper sequence. 5 years ago, my family circle consisted of 5 persons. My grandfather, my father, 2 brothers, and myself, the baby of the family. My mother died, you know, when I was a few weeks old. Now..." His voice broke, and for a moment he was unable to continue. "There's only myself left," he went on. "And so help me God, I'm going too, unless you can solve this damnable mystery that hovers over this house, and put an end to that something which took my kin and is gradually taking me. Granddad was the first to go. He spent the last few years of his life in South America. Just before leaving there, he was attacked while asleep by one of those huge bats. Next morning, he was so weak that he couldn't walk. That awful thing had sucked his lifeblood away. He arrived here, but was sickly until his death a few weeks later. The doctors couldn't agree as to the cause of death, so they led it to old age and let it go at that. But I knew better. It was his experience in the South that had done for him. In his will, he asked that a crypt be built immediately and his body interred therein. His wish was carried out, and his remains lie in that little grey vault that you may have noticed if you cut around behind the house. Then my dad began failing and just pined away until he died. What puzzled the doctors was the fact that right up until the end, he consumed enough food to sustain 3 men, yet he was so weak he lacked the strength to drag his legs over the floor. He was buried, or rather interred, with Granddad. The same symptoms were in evidence in the cases of George and Fred. They are both lying in the vault. And now, Jack, I'm going too, for of late my appetite has increased to alarming proportions, yet I am as weak as a kitten." "Nonsense," I chided. "We'll just leave this place for a while and take a trip somewhere, and when you return, you'll laugh at your fears. It's all a case of overwrought nerves, and there is certainly nothing strange about the deaths you speak of, probably due to some hereditary disease. More than one family has passed out in a hurry just on that account." "Jack, I only wish I could think so, but somehow I know better. And as for leaving here, I just can't. Understand, I hate the place. I loathe it, but I can't get away. There is a morbid fascination about the place which holds me. If you want to be a real friend, just stay with me for a couple of days, and if you don't find anything, I'm sure the sight of you and the sound of your voice will do wonders for me." I agreed to do my best, although I was hard put to it to keep from smiling at his fears, so apparently groundless were they. We talked on other subjects for several hours. Then I proposed bed, saying that I was very tired after my journey and subsequent walk. Remsen showed me to my room, and after seeing that everything was as comfortable as possible, he bade me good night. As he turned to leave the room, the flickering light from the lamp fell on his neck, and I noticed two small punctures in the skin. I questioned him regarding them, but he replied that he must have beheaded a pimple and that he hadn't noticed them before. He again said good night and left the room. I undressed and tumbled into bed. During the night, I was conscious of an overpowering feeling of suffocation, as if some great burden was lying on my chest which I could not dislodge. And in the morning, when I awoke, I experienced a curious sensation of weakness. I arose, not without an effort, and began divesting myself of my sleeping suit. As I folded the jacket, I noticed a thin line of blood on the collar. I felt my neck, a terrible fear overwhelming me. It pained slightly at the touch. I rushed to examine it in the mirror. Two tiny dots rimmed with blood, my blood, and on my neck. No longer did I chuckle at Remsen's fears, for it, the thing, had attacked me as I slept. I dressed as quickly as my condition would permit and went downstairs, thinking to find my friend there. He was not about, so I looked outside, but he was not in evidence. There was but one answer to the question. He had not yet risen. It was 9 o'clock, so I resolved to awaken him. Not knowing which room he occupied, I entered one after another in a fruitless search. They were all in various stages of disorder, and the thick coating of dust on the furniture showed that they had been untenanted for some time. At last, in a bedroom on the north side of the third floor, I found him. He was lying spread-eagle fashion across the bed, still in his pajamas, and as I leaned forward to shake him, my eyes fell on two drops of blood, splattered on the coverlet. I crushed back a wild desire to scream, and shook Remsen rather roughly. His head rolled to one side, and the hellish perforations on his throat showed up vividly. They looked fresh and raw, and had increased to much greater dimensions. I shook him with increased vigor, and at last he opened his eyes stupidly and looked around. Then, seeing me, he said in a voice loaded with anguish, resignation, and despair, "It's been here again, Jack. I can't hold out much longer. May God take my soul when I go." So saying, he fell back again from sheer weakness. I left him and went about preparing myself some breakfast. I thought it best not to destroy his faith in me by telling him that I, too, had suffered at the hands of his persecutor. A walk brought me some peace of mind, if not a solution, and when I returned about noon to the big house, Remsen was up and about. Together we prepared a really excellent meal. I was hungry and did justice to my share, but after I had finished, my friend continued eating until I thought he must either disgorge or bust. Then, after putting things to rights, we strolled about the long hall, looking at the oil paintings, many of which were very valuable. At one end of the hall I discovered a portrait of an old gentleman, evidently a dandy of his day. He wore his hair in the long, flowing fashion adopted by the old school, and sported a carefully trimmed moustache and Van Dyke beard. Remsen noticed my interest in the painting and came forward.
"I don't wonder that picture holds your interest, Jack. It has a great fascination for me also. At times I sit for hours studying the expression on that face. I sometimes think that he has something to tell me, but of course that's all tommyrot. But I beg your pardon, I haven't introduced the old gent yet, have I? This is my granddad. He was a great old boy in his day, and he might be living yet but for that cursed bloodsucker. Perhaps it is such a creature that is doing for me. What do you think?"
"I wouldn't like to venture an opinion, Remsen, but unless I'm badly mistaken, we must dig deeper for an explanation. We'll know tonight, however. You retire as usual, and I'll keep a close watch, and we'll solve the riddle or die in the attempt." Remsen said not a word, but silently extended his hand. I clasped it in a firm embrace, and in each other's eyes we read complete understanding. To change the trend of thought, I questioned him on the servant problem. "I've tried time and again to get servants that would stay," he replied. "But about the third day, they would begin acting queer, and the first thing I'd know, they'd have skipped bag and baggage." That night, I accompanied my friend to his room and remained until he had disrobed and was ready to retire. Several of the window panes were cracked, and one was entirely missing. I suggested boarding up the aperture, but he declined, saying that he rather enjoyed the night air, so I dropped the matter. As it was still early, I sat by the fire in the sitting room and read for an hour or two. I confess that there were many times when my mind wandered from the printed page before me and chills raced up and down my spine as some new sound was borne to my ears. The wind had risen and was whistling through the trees with a peculiar whining sound. The creaking of the shutters tended to further the eerie effect, and in the distance could be heard the hooting of numerous owls, mingled with the cries of miscellaneous nightfowl and other nocturnal creatures. As I ascended the two flights of steps, the candle in my hand casting grotesque shadows on the walls and ceiling, I had little liking for my job. Many times in the course of duty I had been called upon to display courage, but it took more than mere courage to keep me going now. I extinguished the candle and crept forward to Remsen's room, the door of which was closed. Being careful to make no noise, I knelt and looked in at the keyhole. It afforded me a clear view of the bed and two of the windows in the opposite wall. Gradually, my eye became accustomed to the darkness, and I noticed a faint reddish glow outside one of the windows. It apparently emanated from nowhere. Hundreds of little specks danced and whirled in the spot of light, and as I watched them, fascinated, they seemed to take on the form of a human face. The features were masculine, as was also the arrangement of the hair. Then the mysterious globe disappeared. So great had the strain been on me that I was wet from perspiration, although the night was quite cool. For a moment I was undecided whether to enter the room or to stay where I was and use the keyhole as a means of observation. I concluded that to remain where I was would be the better plan, so I once more placed my eye to the hole. Immediately my attention was drawn to something moving where the light had been. At first, owing to the poor light, I was unable to distinguish the general outline and form of the thing. Then I saw. It was a man's head. I will swear it was the exact reproduction of that picture I had seen in the hall that very morning, but oh, the difference in expression! The lips were drawn back in a snarl, disclosing two sets of pearly white teeth, the canines overdeveloped and remarkably sharp. The eyes, an emerald green in colour, stared in a look of consuming hate. The hair was sadly disarranged, while on the beard was a large clot of what seemed to be congealed blood. I noticed thus much, then the head melted from my sight, and I transferred my attention to a great bat that circled round and round, his huge wings beating a tattoo on the glass. Finally, he circled round the broken pane and flew straight through the hole made by the missing glass. For a few moments, he was shut off from my view. Then he reappeared and began circling round my friend, who lay sound asleep, blissfully ignorant of all that was occurring. Nearer and nearer it drew, then swooped down and fastened itself on Remsen's throat, just over the jugular vein. At this, I rushed into the room and made a wild dash for the thing that had come night after night to gorge itself on my friend, but to no avail. It flew out of the window and away, and I turned my attention to the sleeper. "Remsen, old man, get up." He sat up like a shot. "What's the matter, Jack? Has it been here?" "Never mind just now," I replied. "Just dress as hurriedly as possible. We have a little work before us this evening." He glanced questioningly towards me, but followed my command without argument. I turned and cast my eye about the room for a suitable weapon. There was a stout stick lying in the corner, and I made toward it. "Jack!" I wheeled about. "What is it? Damn it, haven't you any sense, almost scaring a man to death?" He pointed a shaking finger towards the window. "There! I swear I saw him. It was my granddad, but oh, how disfigured!" He threw himself upon the bed and began sobbing. The shock had completely unnerved him. "Forgive me, old man," I pleaded. "I was too quick. Pull yourself together, and we may get to the bottom of things tonight yet." I handed him my flask. He took a generous swallow and squared up. When he had finished dressing, we left the house. There was no moon out, and it was pitch dark. I led the way, and soon we came to within 10 yards of the little grey crypt. I stationed Remsen behind a tree with instructions to just use his eyes, and I took up my stand on the other side of the vault, after making sure that the door into it was closed and locked. For the greater part of an hour, we waited without results, and I was about ready to call it off when I perceived a white figure flitting between the trees about 50 yards off. Slowly it advanced, straight towards us, and as it drew closer, I looked not at it, but through it. The wind was blowing strongly, yet not a fold in the long shroud quivered. Just outside the vault it paused and looked around. Even knowing as I did about what to expect, it came as a decided shock when I looked into the eyes of the old Holroyd, deceased these past 5 years. I heard a gasp and knew that Remsen had seen too and had recognized. Then the spirit, ghost or whatever it was, passed into the crypt through the crack between the door and the jamb, a space not 1/16 of an inch wide. As it disappeared, Remsen came running forward, his face wholly drawn of colour. "What was it, Jack? What was it? I know it resembled Grandad, but it couldn't have been he. He's been dead 5 years." "Let's go back to the house," I answered, "and I'll do my best to explain things to the best of my ability. I may be wrong, of course, but it won't hurt to try my remedy. Remsen, what we are up against is a vampire. Not the female species usually spoken of today, but the real thing. I noticed you had an old edition of the Encyclopedia on your shelf. If you could bring me volume 24, I'll be able to explain more fully the meaning of the word." He left the room and returned, carrying the desired book. Turning to page 52, I read, "Vampire, a term apparently of Serbian origin, originally applied in Eastern Europe to blood-sucking ghosts, but in modern usage transferred to one or more species of blood-sucking bats inhabiting South America. In the first mentioned meaning, a vampire is usually supposed to be the soul of a dead man which quits the buried body by night to suck the blood of living persons. Hence, when the vampire's grave is opened, his corpse is found to be fresh and rosy from the blood thus absorbed. They are accredited with the power of assuming any form they may so desire, and often fly about as specks of dust, pieces of down or straw, etc. To put an end to his ravages, a stake is driven through him, or his head cut off, or his heart torn out, or boiling water and vinegar poured over the grave. The persons who turn vampires are wizards, witches, suicides, and those who have come to a violent end. Also, the death of anyone resulting from these vampires will cause that person to join their hellish throng. See Calumet's Dissertation on the Vampires of Hungary." I looked at Remsen. He was staring straight into the fire. I knew that he realized the task before us and was steeling himself to it. Then he turned to me. "Jack, we'll wait till morning." That was all. I understood, and he knew. There we sat, each struggling with his own thoughts, until the first faint glimmers of light came struggling through the trees and warned us of approaching dawn. Remsen left to fetch a sledgehammer and a large knife with its edge honed to a razor-like keenness. I busied myself making four wooden stakes, shaped like wedges. He returned, bearing the horrible tools, and we struck out towards the crypt. We walked rapidly, for had either of us hesitated an instant, I verily believe both would have fled. However, our duty lay clearly before us. Remsen unlocked the door and swung it outwards. With a prayer on our lips, we entered. As if by mutual understanding, we both turned to the coffin on our left. It belonged to the grandfather. We unplaced the lid, and there lay the old Holroyd. He appeared to be sleeping. His face was full of colour, and he had none of the stiffness of death. The hair was matted, the moustache untrimmed, and on the beard were matted stains of a dull brownish hue. But it was his eyes that attracted me. They were greenish, and they glowed with an expression of fiendish malevolence such as I had never seen before. The look of baffled rage on the face might well have adorned the features of the devil in his hell. Remsen swayed and would have fallen, but I forced some whiskey down his throat and he took a grip on himself. He placed one of the stakes directly over its heart, then shut his eyes and prayed that the good God above take this soul that was to be delivered to him. I took a step backward, aimed carefully, and swung the sledgehammer with all my strength. It hit the wedge squarely, and a terrible scream filled the place, while the blood gushed out of the open wound up and over us, staining the walls and our clothes. Without hesitating, I swung again and again and again, while it struggled vainly to rid itself of that awful instrument of death. Another swing, and the stake was driven through. The thing squirmed about in the narrow confines of the coffin, much after the manner of a dismembered worm, and Remsen proceeded to sever the head from the body, making a rather crude but effectual job of it. As the final stroke of the knife cut the connection, a scream issued from the mouth, and the whole corpse fell away into dust, leaving nothing but a wooden stake lying in a bed of bones. This finished, we dispatched the remaining three. Simultaneously, as if struck by the same thought, we felt our throats. The slight pain was gone from mine, and the wounds had entirely disappeared from my friend's, leaving not even a scar. I wished to place before the world the whole facts contingent upon the mystery and the solution, but Remsen prevailed upon me to hold my peace. Some years later, Remsen died a Christian death, and with him went the only confirmation of my tale. However, 10 miles from the little town of Charing there sits an old house, forgotten these many years, and near it is a little grey crypt. Within are 4 coffins, and in each lies a wooden stake, stained a brownish hue, and bearing the fingerprints of the deceased Remsen Holroyd.
The Room in the Tower and Mrs. Amworth by E. F. Benson. Edward Frederick Benson, 1867 to 1940, was born in Wokingham, Berkshire, England, and had early success with a society novel, Dodo, 1893, which remained in print for more than 80 years. It enabled him to devote himself full-time to writing, and he produced a prodigious amount of work in social satire, notably the series about Emmeline Lucia Lucas and Elizabeth Mapp, which was adapted for TV by London Weekend Television as Lucia and Mapp in 1985 to 1986. He also wrote highly regarded biographies, including the standard one at the time for Charlotte Bronte. Benson wrote more than 70 books in all. While most of his fiction is now predictably dated, his frequent forays into the realm of supernatural and horror fiction remain high points in the literature. Among his novels in the genre are The Judgment Books, 1895, The Angel of Pain, 1905, Across the Stream, 1919, Colin, a Novel, 1923, Colin II, 1925, The Inheritor, 1930, and Raven's Brood, 1934. Even more cherished than the novels are the short stories, of which the unquestioned masterpieces are The Room in the Tower, Mrs. Amworth, and caterpillars. The Room in the Tower was first published in The Room in the Tower and Other Stories, London, Mills and Boone, 1912. Mrs. Amworth was first collected in book form in Visible and Invisible, London, Hutchinson, 1923.
The Room in the Tower by E.F. Benson. Read by Simon Vance. It is probable that everybody who is at all a constant dreamer has had at least one experience of an event, or a sequence of circumstances which have come to his mind in sleep, being subsequently realized in the material world. But, in my opinion, so far from this being a strange thing, it would be far odder if this fulfillment did not occasionally happen, since our dreams are, as a rule, concerned with people whom we know and places with which we are familiar, such as might very naturally occur in the awakened, daylit world. True, these dreams are often broken into by some absurd and fantastic incident which puts them out of court in regard to their subsequent fulfillment, but on the mere calculation of chances it does not appear in the least unlikely that a dream imagined by anyone who dreams constantly should occasionally come true. Not long ago, for instance, I experienced such a fulfillment of a dream which seems to me in no way remarkable, and to have no kind of psychical significance. The manner of it was as follows. A certain friend of mine living abroad is amiable enough to write to me about once in a fortnight. Thus, when 14 days or thereabouts have elapsed since I last heard from him, my mind, probably either consciously or subconsciously, is expectant of a letter from him. One night last week I dreamed that as I was going upstairs to dress for dinner I heard, as I often heard, the sound of the postman's knock on my front door, and diverted my direction downstairs instead. There, among other correspondence, was a letter from him. Thereafter the fantastic entered, for on opening it I found inside the Ace of Diamonds, and scribbled across it in his well-known handwriting, "I am sending you this for safe custody, as you know it is running an unreasonable risk to keep aces in Italy." The next evening I was just preparing to go upstairs to dress when I heard the postman's knock, and did precisely as I had done in my dream. There, among other letters, was one for my friend. Only it did not contain the Ace of Diamonds. Had it done so, I should have attached more weight to the matter, which, as it stands, seems to me a perfectly ordinary coincidence. No doubt I consciously or subconsciously expected a letter from him, and this suggested to me my dream. Similarly, the fact that my friend had not written to me for a fortnight suggested to him that he should do so. But occasionally it is not so easy to find such an explanation, and for the following story I can find no explanation at all. It came out of the dark, and into the dark it has gone again. All my life I have been a habitual dreamer. The nights are few, that is to say, when I do not find on awaking in the morning that some mental experience has been mine, and sometimes all night long, apparently, a series of the most dazzling adventures before me. Almost without exception, these adventures are pleasant, though often merely trivial. It is of an exception that I am going to speak. It was when I was about 16 that a certain dream first came to me, and this is how it befell. It opened with my being set down at the door of a big, red-brick house, where I understood I was going to stay. The servant who opened the door told me that tea was being served in the garden, and led me through a low, dark-panelled hall with a large, open fireplace onto a cheerful green lawn set round with flower-beds. There were grouped about the tea-table a small party of people, but they were all strangers to me, except one, who was a schoolfellow called Jack Stone, clearly the son of the house, and he introduced me to his mother and father and a couple of sisters. I was, I remember, somewhat astonished to find myself here, for the boy in question was scarcely known to me, and I rather disliked what I knew of him. Moreover, he had left school nearly a year before. The afternoon was very hot, and an intolerable oppression reigned. On the far side of the lawn ran a red brick wall with an iron gate in its centre, outside which stood a walnut tree. We sat in the shadow of the house, opposite a row of long windows, inside which I could see a table with cloth laid, glimmering with glass and silver. This garden front of the house was very long, and at one end of it stood a tower of 3 stories, which looked to me much older than the rest of the building. Before long, Mrs. Stone, who, like the rest of the party, had sat in absolute silence, said to me, "Jack will show you your room. I have given you the room in the tower." Quite inexplicably, my heart sank at her words. I felt as if I had known that I should have the room in the tower, and that it contained something dreadful and significant. Jack instantly got up, and I understood that I had to follow him. In silence we passed through the hall and mounted a great oak staircase with many corners, and arrived at a small landing with two doors set in it. He pushed one of them open for me to enter, and without coming in himself closed it after me. Then I knew that my conjecture had been right. There was something awful in the room. And with a terror of nightmare growing swiftly and enveloping me, I awoke in a spasm of terror. Now that dream, all variations on it, occurred to me intermittently for 15 years. More often it came in exactly this form: the arrival, the tea laid out on the lawn, the deadly silence succeeded by that one deadly sentence, the mounting with Jack Stone up to the room in the tower where horror dwelt, and it always came to a close in the nightmare of terror at that which was in the room, though I never saw what it was. At other times I experienced variations on this same theme. Occasionally, for instance, we would be sitting at dinner in the dining-room, into the windows of which I had looked on the first night, when the dream of this house visited me, but wherever we were, there was the same silence, the same sense of dreadful oppression and foreboding. And the silence, I knew, would always be broken by Mrs. Stone saying to me, "Jack will show you your room. I have given you the room in the tower." Upon which, this was invariable, I had to follow him up the oak staircase with many corners, and enter the place that I dreaded more and more each time that I visited it in sleep. Or, again, I would find myself playing cards still in silence, in a drawing-room lit with immense chandeliers that gave a blinding illumination. What the game was, I have no idea. What I remember, with a sense of miserable anticipation, was that soon Mrs. Stone would get up and say to me, "Jack will show you your room. I have given you the room in the tower." This drawing-room, where we played cards, was next to the dining-room, and, as I have said, was always brilliantly illuminated, whereas the rest of the house was full of dusk and shadows. And yet, how often, in spite of those bouquets of lights, have I not pored over the cards that were dealt me, scarcely able for some reason to see them? Their designs, too, were strange. There were no red suits, but all were black, and among them there were certain cards which were black all over. I hated and dreaded those. As this dream continued to recur, I got to know the greater part of the house. There was a smoking-room beyond the drawing-room at the end of a passage with a green baize door. It was always very dark there, and as often as I went there I passed somebody whom I could not see in the doorway coming out. Curious developments, too, took place in the characters that peopled the dream, as might happen to living persons. Mrs. Stone, for instance, who, when I first saw her, had been black-haired, became grey, and instead of rising briskly, as she had done at first, when she said, "Jack will show you your room, I have given you the room in the tower," got up very feebly, as if the strength was leaving her limbs. Jack also grew up, and became a rather ill-looking young man with a brown moustache, while one of the sisters ceased to appear, and I understood she was married. Then it so happened that I was not visited by this dream for 6 months or more, and I began to hope, in such inexplicable dread did I hold it, that it had passed away for good. But one night after this interval I again found myself being shown out onto the lawn for tea, and Mrs. Stone was not there, while the others were all dressed in black. At once I guessed the reason, and my heart leaped at the thought that perhaps this time I should not have to sleep in the room in the tower, and though we usually all sat in silence, on this occasion the sense of relief made me talk and laugh as I had never yet done. But even then matters were not altogether comfortable, for no one else spoke, but they all looked secretly at each other. And soon the foolish stream of my talk ran dry, and gradually an apprehension worse than anything I had previously known gained on me, as the light slowly faded. Suddenly a voice which I knew well broke the stillness, the voice of Mrs. Stone saying, "Jack will show you your room. I have given you the room in the tower." It seemed to come from near the gate in the red brick wall that bounded the lawn, and looking up, I saw that the grass outside was sown thick with gravestones. A curious greyish light shone from them, and I could read the lettering on the grave nearest me, and it was, In Evil Memory of Julia Stone. And as usual, Jack got up, and again I followed him through the hall and up the staircase with many corners. On this occasion it was darker than usual, and when I passed into the room in the tower I could only just see the furniture, the position of which was already familiar to me. Also there was a dreadful odour of decay in the room, and I woke screaming. The dream, with such variations and developments as I have mentioned, went on at intervals for 15 years. Sometimes I would dream it 2 or 3 nights in succession. Once, as I have said, there was an intermission of 6 months. But taking a reasonable average, I should say that I dreamed it quite as often as once in a month. It had, as is plain, something of nightmare about it, since it always ended in the same appalling terror, which, so far from getting less, seemed to me to gather fresh fear every time that I experienced it. There was, too, a strange and dreadful consistency about it. The characters in it, as I have mentioned, got regularly older. Death and marriage visited this silent family, and I never in the dream after Mrs. Stone had died set eyes on her again. But it was always her voice that told me that the room in the tower was prepared for me, and whether we had tea out on the lawn, or the scene was laid in one of the rooms overlooking it, I could always see her gravestone standing just outside the iron gate. It was the same, too, with the married daughter. Usually she was not present, but once or twice she returned again in company with a man, whom I took to be her husband. He, too, like the rest of them, was always silent. But, owing to the constant repetition of the dream, I had ceased to attach in my waking hours any significance to it. I never met Jack Stone again during all those years, nor did I ever see a house that resembled this dark house of my dream. And then something happened. I had been in London in this year up till the end of July, and during the first week in August went down to stay with a friend in a house he had taken for the summer months in the Ashdown Forest district of Sussex. I left London early, for John Clinton was to meet me at Forest Row Station, and we were going to spend the day golfing and go to his house in the evening. He had his motor with him, and we set off about 5 of the afternoon, after a thoroughly delightful day for the drive, the distance being some 10 miles. As it was still so early, we did not have tea at the clubhouse, but waited till we should get home. As we drove, the weather, which up till then had been, though hot, deliciously fresh, seemed to me to alter in quality and become very stagnant and oppressive, and I felt that indefinable sense of ominous apprehension that I am accustomed to before thunder. John, however, did not share my views, attributing my loss of lightness to the fact that I had lost both my matches. Events proved, however, that I was right, though I do not think that the thunderstorm that broke that night was the sole cause of my depression. Our way lay through deep, high-banked lanes, and before we had gone very far I fell asleep, and was only awakened by the stopping of the motor. And with a sudden thrill, partly of fear but chiefly of curiosity, I found myself standing in the doorway of my house of dream. We went, I half wondering whether or not I was dreaming still, through a low oak-panelled hall and out onto the lawn, where tea was laid in the shadow of the house. It was set in flower beds, a red brick wall with a gate in it bounded one side, and out beyond that was a space of rough grass with a walnut tree. The facade of the house was very long, and at one end stood a 3-storied tower, markedly older than the rest. Here, for the moment, all resemblance to the repeated dream ceased. There was no silent and somehow terrible family, but a large assembly of exceedingly cheerful persons, all of whom were known to me. And in spite of the horror with which the dream itself had always filled me, I felt nothing of it now that the scene of it was thus reproduced before me. But I felt intensest curiosity as to what was going to happen. Tea pursued its cheerful course, and before long Mrs. Clinton got up. And at that moment I think I knew what she was going to say. She spoke to me, and what she said was, "Jack will show you to your room. I have given you the room in the tower." At that, for half a second, the horror of the dream took hold of me again. But it quickly passed, and again I felt nothing more than the most intense curiosity. It was not very long before it was amply satisfied. John turned to me. "Right up at the top of the house," he said. "But I think you'll be comfortable. We're absolutely full up. Would you like to go and see it now?" By Jove, I believe that you are right, and that we are going to have a thunderstorm. How dark it has become. I got up and followed him. We passed through the hall, and up the perfectly familiar staircase. Then he opened the door, and I went in. And at that moment, sheer unreasoning terror again possessed me. I did not know for certain what I feared. I simply feared. Then, like a sudden recollection, when one remembers a name which has long escaped the memory, I knew what I feared. I feared Mrs. Stone, whose grave, with a sinister inscription, "In Evil Memory," I had so often seen in my dream, just beyond the lawn which lay below my window. And then once more the fear passed so completely that I wondered what there was to fear, and I found myself, sober and quiet and sane, in the room in the tower, the name of which I had so often heard in my dream, and the scene of which was so familiar. I looked round it with a certain sense of proprietorship, and found that nothing had been changed from the dreaming nights in which I knew it so well. Just to the left of the door was the bed, lengthways along the wall, with the head of it in the angle. In a line with it was the fireplace and a small bookcase. Opposite the door, the outer wall was pierced by two lattice-paned windows, between which stood the dressing-table, while ranged along the fourth wall was the washing-stand and a big cupboard. My luggage had already been unpacked, for the furniture of dressing and undressing lay orderly on the wash-stand and toilet-table, while my dinner clothes were spread out on the coverlet of the bed. And then, with a sudden start of unexplained dismay, I saw that there were two rather conspicuous objects which I had not seen before in my dreams. One, a life-sized oil painting of Mrs. Stone. The other, a black-and-white sketch of Jack Stone, representing him as he had appeared to me only a week before in the last of the series of these repeated dreams, a rather secret and evil-looking man of about 30. His picture hung between the windows, looking straight across the room to the other portrait, which hung at the side of the bed. At that I looked next, and as I looked I felt once more the horror of nightmare seize me. It represented Mrs. Stone as I had seen her last in my dreams, old and withered and white-haired. But in spite of the evident feebleness of body, a dreadful exuberance and vitality shone through the envelope of flesh, an exuberance wholly malign, a vitality that foamed and frothed with unimaginable evil. Evil beamed from the narrow, leering eyes. It laughed in the demon-like mouth. The whole face was instinct with some secret and appalling mirth. The hands, clasped together on the knee, seemed shaking with suppressed and nameless glee. Then I saw also that it was signed in the left-hand bottom corner, and wondering who the artist could be, I looked more closely and read the inscription. Julia Stone by Julia Stone. There came a tap at the door, and John Clinton entered. "Got everything you want?" he asked. "Rather more than I want," said I, pointing to the picture. He laughed. "Hard-featured old lady," he said. "By herself, too, I remember. Anyhow, she can't have flattered herself much." "But don't you see," said I, "it's scarcely a human face at all. It's the face of some witch, of some devil." He looked at it more closely. "Yes, it isn't very pleasant," he said. "Scarcely a bedside manner, eh? Yes, I can imagine getting the nightmare if I went to sleep with that close by my bed. I'll have it taken down if you like." "I really wish you would," I said. He rang the bell, and with the help of a servant, we detached the picture and carried it out onto the landing and put it with its face to the wall. "By Jove, the old lady is a weight," said John, mopping his forehead. "I wonder if she had something on her mind." The extraordinary weight of the picture had struck me too. I was about to reply when I caught sight of my own hand. There was blood on it, in considerable quantities, covering the whole palm. "I've cut myself somehow," said I. John gave a little startled exclamation. "Why, I have too," he said. Simultaneously the footman took out his handkerchief and wiped his hand with it. I saw that there was blood also on his handkerchief. John and I went back into the tower room and washed the blood off. But neither on his hand nor on mine was there the slightest trace of a scratch or cut. It seemed to me that, having ascertained this, we both, by a sort of tacit consent, did not allude to it again. Something in my case had dimly occurred to me that I did not wish to think about. It was but a conjecture, but I fancied that I knew the same thing had occurred to him. The heat and oppression of the air, for the storm we had expected was still undischarged, increased very much after dinner. And for some time most of the party, among whom were John Clinton and myself, sat outside on the path bounding the lawn, where we had had tea. The night was absolutely dark, and no twinkle of star or moon ray could penetrate the pall of cloud that overset the sky. By degrees our assembly thinned, the women went up to bed, men dispersed to the smoking or billiard room, and by 11 o'clock my host and I were the only two left. All the evening I thought that he had something on his mind, and as soon as we were alone he spoke. "The man who helped us with the picture had blood on his hand too, did you notice?" he said. I asked him just now if he had cut himself, and he said he supposed he had, but that he could find no mark of it. Now where did that blood come from? By dint of telling myself that I was not going to think about it, I had succeeded in not doing so, and I did not want, especially just at bedtime, to be reminded of it. "I don't know," said I, "and I don't really care so long as the picture of Mrs. Stone is not by my bed." He got up. "But it's odd," he said. "Ha! Now you'll see another odd thing." A dog of his, an Irish terrier by breed, had come out of the house as we talked. The door behind us into the hall was open, and a bright oblong of light shone across the lawn to the iron gate which led onto the rough grass outside where the walnut tree stood. I saw that the dog had all his hackles up, bristling with rage and fright. His lips were curled back from his teeth as if he was ready to spring at something, and he was growling to himself. He took not the slightest notice of his master or me, but stiffly and tensely walked across the grass to the iron gate. There he stood for a moment, looking through the bars and still growling. Then of a sudden his courage seemed to desert him. He gave one long howl and scuttled back to the house with a curious crouching sort of movement. "He does that half a dozen times a day," said John. "He sees something which he both hates and fears." I walked to the gate and looked over it. Something was moving on the grass outside, and soon a sound which I could not instantly identify came to my ears. Then I remembered what it was. It was the purring of a cat. I lit a match and saw the purrer, a big blue Persian, walking round and round in a little circle just outside the gate, stepping high and ecstatically, with tail carried aloft like a banner. Its eyes were bright and shining, and every now and then it put its head down and sniffed at the grass. I laughed. "The end of that mystery, I'm afraid," I said. "Here's a large cat having Valpurgis night all alone." "Yes, that's Darius," said John. "He spends half the day and all night there. But that's not the end of the dog mystery, for Toby and he are the best of friends, but the beginning of the cat mystery. What's the cat doing there? And why is Darius pleased while Toby is terror-stricken?" At that moment I remembered the rather horrible detail of my dreams when I saw through the gate just where the cat was now, the white tombstone with a sinister inscription. But before I could answer, the rain began, as suddenly and heavily as if a tap had been turned on, and simultaneously the big cat squeezed through the bars of the gate and came leaping across the lawn to the house for shelter. Then it sat in the doorway, looking out eagerly into the dark. It spat and struck at John with its paw as he pushed it in order to close the door. Somehow, with the portrait of Julia Stone in the passage outside, the room in the tower had absolutely no alarm for me, and as I went to bed feeling very sleepy and heavy, I had nothing more than interest for the curious incident about our bleeding hands and the conduct of the cat and dog. The last thing I looked at before I put out my light was the square, empty space by my bed where the portrait had been. Here the paper was of its original, full tint of dark red. Over the rest of the walls it had faded. Then I blew out my candle and instantly fell asleep. My awaking was equally instantaneous, and I sat bolt upright in bed under the impression that some bright light had been flashed in my face, though it was now absolutely pitch dark. I knew exactly where I was, in the room which I had dreaded in dreams, but no horror that I ever felt when asleep approached the fear that now invaded and froze my brain. Immediately after, a peal of thunder crackled just above the house, but the probability that it was only a flash of lightning which awoke me gave no reassurance to my galloping heart. Something, I knew, was in the room with me, and instinctively I put out my right hand, which was nearest the wall, to keep it away, and my hand touched the edge of a picture frame hanging close to me. I sprang out of bed, upsetting the small table that stood by it, and I heard my watch, candle, and matches clatter onto the floor. But for the moment there was no need of light, for a blinding flash leaped out of the clouds and showed me that by my bed again hung the picture of Mrs. Stone. And instantly the room went into blackness again. But in that flash I saw another thing also, namely a figure that leaned over the end of my bed, watching me. It was dressed in some close, clinging white garment, spotted and stained with mould, and the face was that of the portrait. Overhead the thunder cracked and roared, and when it ceased and the deathly stillness succeeded, I heard the rustle of movement coming nearer me, and, more horrible yet, perceived an odour of corruption and decay. And then a hand was laid on the side of my neck, and close beside my ear I heard quick, taken, eager breathing. Yet I knew that this thing, though it could be perceived by touch, by smell, by eye and by ear, was still not of this earth, but something that had passed out of the body and had power to make itself manifest. Then a voice, already familiar to me, spoke. "I knew you would come to the room in the tower," it said. "I have been long waiting for you. At last you have come. Tonight I shall feast. Before long we will feast together." And the quick breathing came closer to me. I could feel it on my neck. At that, the terror which I think had paralyzed me for the moment gave way to the wild instinct of self-preservation. I hit wildly with both arms, kicking out at the same moment, and heard a little animal squeal, and something soft dropped with a thud beside me. I took a couple of steps forward, nearly tripping up over whatever it was that lay there, and by the merest good luck found the handle of the door. In another second I ran out on the landing and had banged the door behind me. Almost at the same moment I heard a door open somewhere below, and John Clinton, candle in hand, came running upstairs. "What is it?" he said. "I sleep just below you and heard a noise as if—good heavens, there's blood on your shoulder." I stood there, so he told me afterwards, swaying from side to side, white as a sheet, with a mark on my shoulder as if a hand covered with blood had been laid there. "It's in there," I said, pointing. "She, you know. The portrait is in there too, hanging up on the place we took it from." At that he laughed. "My dear fellow, this is mere nightmare," he said. He pushed by me and opened the door, I standing there simply inert with terror, unable to stop him, unable to move. "Phew, what an awful smell," he said. Then there was silence. He had passed out of my sight behind the open door. Next moment he came out again as white as myself, and instantly shut it. "Yes, the portrait's there," he said. "And on the floor is a thing spotted with earth, like what they bury people in. Come away, quick, come away." How I got downstairs I hardly know. An awful shuddering and nausea of the spirit rather than of the flesh had seized me, and more than once he had to place my feet upon the steps, while every now and then he cast glances of terror and apprehension up the stairs. But in time we came to his dressing-room on the floor below, and there I told him what I have here described. The sequel can be made short. Indeed, some of my readers have perhaps already guessed what it was, if they remember that inexplicable affair of the churchyard at West Fawley, some 8 years ago, where an attempt was made 3 times to bury the body of a certain woman who had committed suicide. On each occasion the coffin was found, in the course of a few days, again protruding from the ground. After the 3rd attempt, in order that the thing should not be talked about, the body was buried elsewhere in unconsecrated ground. Where it was buried was just outside the iron gate of the garden belonging to the house where this woman had lived. She had committed suicide in a room at the top of the tower in that house. Her name was Julia Stone. Subsequently, the body was again secretly dug up, and the coffin was found to be full of blood.
Mrs. Amworth by E. F. Benson. Read by Jonathan Cowley. The village of Maxley, where last summer and autumn these strange events took place, lies on a heathery and pine-clad upland of Sussex. In all England you could not find a sweeter and saner situation. Should the wind blow from the south, it comes laden with the spices of the sea. To the east, high downs protect it from the inclemencies of March, and from the west and north, the breezes which reach it travel over miles of aromatic forest and heather. The village itself is insignificant enough in point of population, but rich in amenities and beauty. Halfway down the single street, with its road and spacious areas of grass on each side, stands the little Norman church and the antique graveyard long disused. For the rest, there are a dozen small, sedate Georgian houses, red-bricked and long-windowed, each with a square of flower garden in front, and an ampler strip behind, a score of shops, and a couple of score of thatched cottages belonging to labourers on neighbouring estates, complete the entire cluster of its peaceful habitations. The general peace, however, is sadly broken on Saturdays and Sundays, for we lie on one of the main roads between London and Brighton, and our quiet street becomes a race course for flying motor cars and bicycles. A notice just outside the village begging them to go slowly only seems to encourage them to accelerate their speed, for the road lies open and straight, and there is really no reason why they should do otherwise. By way of protest, therefore, the ladies of Maxley cover their noses and mouths with their handkerchiefs as they see a motor car approaching, though as the street is asphalted, they need not really take these precautions against dust. But late on Sunday night, the horde of scorchers has passed, and we settle down again to 5 days of cheerful and leisurely seclusion. Railway strikes which agitate the country so much leave us undisturbed, because most of the inhabitants of Maxley never leave it at all. I am the fortunate possessor of one of these small Georgian houses, and consider myself no less fortunate in having so interesting and stimulating a neighbour as Francis Urquham, who, the most confirmed of Maxleyites, has not slept away from his house, which stands just opposite to mine in the village street, for nearly 2 years, at which date, though still in middle life, he resigned his physiological professorship at Cambridge University and devoted himself to the study of those occult and curious phenomena which seem equally to concern the physical and the psychical sides of human nature. Indeed, his retirement was not unconnected with his passion for the strange, uncharted places that lie on the confines and borders of science, the existence of which is so stoutly denied by the more materialistic minds, for he advocated that all medical students should be obliged to pass some sort of examination in mesmerism, and that one of the Tripos papers should be designed to test their knowledge in such subjects as appearances at time of death, haunted houses, vampirism, automatic writing, and possession. Of course they wouldn't listen to me, ran his account of the matter, for there is nothing that these seats of learning are so frightened of as knowledge, and the road to knowledge lies in the study of things like these. The functions of the human frame are, broadly speaking, known. They are a country, anyhow, that has been charted and mapped out. But outside that lie huge tracts of undiscovered country, which certainly exist. And the real pioneers of knowledge are those who, at the cost of being derided as credulous and superstitious, want to push on into those misty and probably perilous places. I felt that I could be of more use by setting out without compass or knapsack into the mists than by sitting in a cage like a canary and chirping about what was known. Besides, teaching is very bad for a man who knows himself only to be a learner. You only need to be a self-conceited ass to teach. Here, then, in Francis Urquham, was a delightful neighbour to one who, like myself, has an uneasy and burning curiosity about what he called the misty and perilous places. And this last spring, we had a further and most welcome addition to our pleasant little community, in the person of Mrs. Amworth, widow of an Indian civil servant. Her husband had been a judge in the Northwest Provinces, and after his death at the Peshawar, she came back to England, and after a year in London found herself starving for the ampler air and sunshine of the country to take the place of the fogs and griminess of town. She had, too, a special reason for settling in Maxley, since her ancestors up till 100 years ago had long been native to the place, and in the old churchyard, now disused, are many gravestones bearing her maiden name of Chaston. Big and energetic, her vigorous and genial personality speedily woke Maxley up to a higher degree of sociality than it had ever known. Most of us were bachelors, or spinsters, or elderly folk, not much inclined to exert ourselves in the expense and effort of hospitality. And hitherto, the gaiety of a small tea party, with bridge afterwards and galoshes, when it was wet, to trip home in again for a solitary dinner, was about the climax of our festivities. But Mrs. Amworth showed us a more gregarious way, and set an example of luncheon parties and little dinners, which we began to follow. On other nights, when no such hospitality was on foot,